after I killed you guys last week with that extra long class, I think tonight we're going to go shorter, so I'm going to try to go easy on everyone, you know. We'll try to recover from all that Reformation nonsense. So, not nonsense, it was wonderful, but, you know, sorry, that was just a phrase. It didn't really mean anything. All right, well, let's pray, and then we'll get cranking here. So, Lord, we do pray that you would just bless our time tonight. Thank you for bringing everybody here, Lord, and even David, who's not feeling well, Lord, pray that you touch and heal his body, Lord, and just prevent anyone else from getting sick. Maybe that's why James and Mike are gone. I don't know if they're not feeling well or what. So, boy, they better have a good reason. But anyway, I'm just kidding. Lord, I pray that you would just bless, Lord, them, since they're not able to be here tonight for whatever reason, God, and that you bless us as well, and that you would just continue to speak to us, God, continue to teach us, help us to just learn what you would have for us tonight, God, and just continue to just equip these students, Lord, with all the information, and not just information, Lord, but perspective, Lord, your perspective on things that have happened in history, Lord, so that they could go and share that with others. And so just thanks for this group, Lord, and bless these guys. I just appreciate their faithfulness and hard work, Lord. I pray that you would just honor that and bless them and be with them. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay. So, thanks for that. I mentioned last week when we were closing, because I just ran out of time and we were already like, what, 20 minutes over or something crazy. And you guys are awesome because you stuck around even after that, a few of you, to talk about things. But I mentioned I wanted to show you guys like just the general, I guess you'd say denominations or groups or whatever that came out of the different reformers that we looked at last week that started everything. So obviously Luther... as Lutherans, right? And remember, he didn't want them to be called Lutherans. He didn't want them to be called by his name, but they did it anyway. That's just how it goes, unfortunately, with people. They just, you know, people want to find someone to follow. So, Lutherans, and then Calvin, obviously, is the father of all the Reformed churches. The Presbyterian Church takes a lot of their cues from him. Church of Scotland, as well, which is not surprising because you guys might remember. Do you remember the Scottish Reformer we talked about at the end?
John Knox,
right? Knox loved Calvin, right? Remember, he went to Geneva, and he was really impressed and inspired by his example there and everything. So it's not surprising that the Church of Scotland kind of takes on that flavor. And then you have Zwingli, who inspired the Anabaptists, even though they kind of broke off and did their own thing. He was their initial inspiration for what they did. And from the Anabaptists, we get all kinds of groups. We get the Mennonites, the Lutherites, the Quakers, the Amish, Puritans, and the Baptists. Okay, they all came out of that. And the Baptists, that's kind of an obvious one, because that's their big thing, is baptism, I guess, is probably how they got the name in the first place, and that was what the Anabaptists were known for. And then, of course, Henry VIII founded the Church of England. So those were some of the key figures that we looked at and their influence. And, of course, a lot of other groups and denominations emerged later. The Congregationalists were a really big group in the 1700s, then you've got, oh my goodness, the Methodists, who are going to come along. We'll talk about them next week. So a lot of other groups would eventually be founded as well, but these were the initial ones that came out of the Reformation. So, all right, so if you want to just have a nice little concise thing to write down.
Is the Church of Scotland a nationwide church like the way the Church of England is?
Yes. Yeah, I would say yeah. There's the Church of Scotland and there's the Free Church of Scotland. We'll talk about that. That came along later.
Oh, okay.
But yeah. So yeah, it's kind of like that. I think the Church of England is a little bit more on the formal and like the real, you know, official thing. But yeah, it's that same vibe. So yeah, good question. All right. So again, last week, that's what we looked at. The early Reformation and all of these guys, these founding fathers of the Reformation, who developed a lot of the major tenets, the major, I guess you would say, pillars of the faith, of the Protestant faith, in the early, mid-1500s. And so much of what we hold to as Protestants today was articulated at this time, right? We had Luther and his motto of sola scriptura, right, scripture alone, his other, the other pillar he stood on was sola fide, faith alone, justification by faith alone, and then, of course, the priesthood of all believers. Those were his three main focuses. And then we have Calvin with his emphasis on what was Calvin's big theological emphasis?
Sovereignty
of God, predestination, right? All that stuff. And then we have the Anabaptists, and theologically, what did they contribute? Adult baptism. That was kind of, again, the main thing they were known for. They were really big on returning to the Bible, like the other reformers. The other significant characteristic of the Anabaptists was they wanted to break away from secular connection, right? They didn't like the idea of a state church. So they were very unique to the Reformation because a lot of the other reformers were fine with that. They viewed things differently. We've talked about that, so I'm not going to get way into it for the sake of time. And so we did see that, unfortunately, that concept of state church and just the overly concerned mentality towards doctrine and theology, that had its place for sure. The reformers really needed to be focused on theology and really like clarify what the Bible taught and really build sound doctrine on that. But it kind of led to this overemphasis on doctrine at the expense of, missions and preaching the gospel and other kinds of things. And so it got people got so focused on their theological differences and working out these distinctions that it began to get a little bit stale in future generations. And the whole concept of state church kind of threw things off a little bit as well. And so that led to some, like I said, some staleness and a deadness, really, in future generations. Not the reformers themselves, but in future generations, this would kind of slow things down and stunt their growth a little bit. And that's kind of what we see a characteristic of the Church of Sardis that Jesus spoke to in Revelation and told them, hey, be careful, you have a name that you're alive, but you're dead. And the Church of the Reformers had indeed been very much alive, but in future generations, they had only the name that they were alive, and there was death. And we'll talk more about that as we go along, but I just wanted to touch on that briefly because we do have that comparison with the Church of Sardis. So even though some of those emphases that the reformers had, some of their actions led to problems in later generations, the Lord really did use the reformers to revive Europe, obviously. I mean, it was so revolutionary in Christian as well as in secular history. And the Lord used them to bring a lot of people into a living relationship with Jesus, not a religious sense of duty and a burden, but an actual joy and relationship with God. And they provided the opportunity to, for people to read the Word of God, for people to read the Bible for themselves, by providing translations like Luther's German Bible and stuff like that. So they were making the things of God accessible to the common people again, and pulling everyone out from under that Catholic Church domination, right? And so, I should just say Church domination at that stage, but. It'd be kind of weird to just pass on from there as if the Catholic Church had nothing to say or do in response to this, because obviously they're going to react in some way. Look at this map here, and you see, you've got this whole northern, north-central part of Europe in green there, breaking away from the church and breaking away from church rule, church control, church domination. Obviously, they're not going to just let that happen. Maybe at first they didn't really react, but as time went on and they began to see, wow, this is a serious business. Look at all this. Look at how much the face of Europe was changing. The church obviously had to make some kind of a response. They weren't going to just stand by and watch the foundations of medieval Christendom, their Christian empire that they had built. They weren't going to just let that crumble and fall away. So your book does talk about how, surprisingly, initially they didn't make any concerted response to stomp out the Reformation, other than by excommunicating the ringleaders, guys like Luther and stuff. In fact, throughout the 1520s and the 1530s, the church pretty much stayed on the DL with the whole thing. And I think part of that would have been like just to see if this really was just one of those little rebellions that would like flash and then fade away. We had other people calling out for reform earlier, like Peter Waldo and Albigenses and those guys. So I think the church very well believed like it could be another, Luther and Calvin and those guys could be just another, more heretics like that, that were just kind of low. No, you're fine. They were just going to be a flash in the pan. They'll make a big, a you know, make a big splash and then kind of just like fall by the wayside. That was kind of the mentality. And remember, when Luther first posted the 95 Theses, the Pope even said, "Oh, Friar Martin is a fine man, and he makes his points, and they're just squabbling. They'll just work it out for themselves." You know, they didn't realize the implications of this. They didn't realize that Europe was so primed and so ready for reform that it would launch into this huge movement. And so, like I said, initially the Catholic Church didn't really make much of a response. But when they realized this was no longer a minor rebellion, that half of Europe was shaking free from church control, they realized, oh, we need to step in and do something here. This is no bueno. And so that leads us to the Catholic Counter-Reformation. Ooh, the Counter-Reformation. Okay. And your book talks about how this was, the Catholic Counter-Reformation was able to contain the Protestants within the northern third of Europe, which would be technically how things stand today, even though, you know, in reality, there's not really a powerful presence of Christianity anywhere in Europe today. But at least, you know, for all intents and purposes, and for that time, that's what happened, you know, that they were able to kind of contain the church. And you can even see that today in the fact that, you know, Italy, Spain, some of the southern European nations are still heavily Catholic, you know. And so it's just, like I said, it's in name only. Like, sure, Germany is, you know, would be Protestant, or the Netherlands and those sort of things, or those sorts of countries, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're, like, you know, hardcore and passionate about the Lord. As you guys probably know, like I said, Europe is not, this is not exactly in a good place spiritually. So, the Counter-Reformation, to a large degree, it was a practical response to the Reformers. You know, they were responding to this threat that the Reformers posed to the Church. But there was also spiritual reformation that was happening within Catholicism itself. And we saw this with the mystics that, you know, that it had begun centuries earlier. It had begun during the Middle Ages. There were people that wanted reform from within the Church, right? You guys remember from the video where I was talking about some of those early mystics that, you know, like Catherine of Siena and Thomas Aquinas, all those early guys from the Middle Ages that were wanting to see reform happen within the Church. But now all of that, all of those, you know, early voices that wanted reform, it was all kind of coming to a head now under the present circumstances. The Protestants kind of forced the issue, and the Church, the Catholic Church, realized, like, we really do need to kind of get our act together. And so La Tourette says, "The Catholic Reformation is sometimes called the Counter-Reformation, but that designation can be misleading. It is accurate if by it is meant that it was in part a reaction against Protestant criticism and secession, and that through it the Roman Catholic Church regained some of the ground it lost to Protestantism. But it is inaccurate if it is intended to convey the impression that but for Protestantism, the Catholic Reformation would not have come." And then he goes further to say, "It is more than coincidence that the Protestant and Catholic Reformation ran concurrently because they were different expressions of a common fresh burst of life in Christianity." And so, yeah, so essentially what he's saying is, yes, it was in part a reaction to the Reformers, but you can't say that it only happened because of the Reformers. There were already people that wanted reform in the Church. Spiritual reform probably would have taken place anyways in the Church because there were a lot of people that saw the need, that saw the depravity and the corruption and the greed and all that nonsense. You know, people weren't blind, and like we've seen toward the end of the Middle Ages, people were starting more and more to vocalize and verbalize their, you know, their distrust and their skepticism of the way the Church was run. And so, let's talk about this spiritual side of the Counter-Reformation first, and then we'll look at the political side, which would have been more responding to the Reformers. And so I want to just highlight a few people that kind of helped foster spiritual reform, and we'll start first with a couple Catholics that were called to missionary work. You read about them briefly in your book, but I'll give you a few more details about these guys, because they were very influential. And, you know, granted, there were a lot of Catholic explorers who also went out in the name of Christianity. They didn't call themselves missionaries, but they said they were going out as, you know, representatives of the Christian faith and all that sort of thing. And they went out and did horrible things, you know, like Cortez and those guys, the conquistadores, who went in and just did all kinds of horrible stuff and were very oppressive and said they were doing it in the name of God and all that. But and it's true that European governments did take advantage of the concept of evangelism to try to expand their territories and their wealth. But there were some people who really had a right heart to towards spreading the faith. And even if they had wrong doctrine, because it was the Catholic faith that they were spreading, you know, they really did have a sincere desire to serve God and to help people. And so we want to look at those guys. We're not going to look at Cortez and all those dorks, you know, so they were terrible. So, but we do want to look at guys like this, Bartholomew de las Casas. He was a Spaniard, probably kind of obvious based on his name. I would hope you could figure that out. He was the son of a merchant who had sailed with Christopher Columbus to the New World on his second voyage. And so Bartholomew grew up like really interested in the Americas, you know, from all the stories he'd heard from his dad. And so after he went off to the university and took his degree in law, he went and settled on the island of Hispaniola, which would be modern-day Dominican Republic and Haiti. You know how they share that island? So that was Hispaniola back in the day. And so he went there to serve as the governor's legal advisor. And, you know, he got, it's kind of quite naturally, he got kind of sucked into the whole posh lifestyle of the colonists, you know, and he was just living a wealthy, comfortable life, and he held the common view that everybody else had, that the Indians were an inferior race, so he was, you know, very racist, like a lot of the other Spaniards were, that they needed to just subdue these Indians, and he even enslaved Indians on his plantation. So he was no different than any of the other colonists at that time. But in 1510, so he was, what, his mid-30s, he had this spiritual experience where he suddenly had this desire to become a priest. And so he didn't change a whole lot initially, but as he began to, you know, try to devote himself to the things of God, he started to have a change of heart towards his lifestyle, to the way he had been treating the Indians. He started to feel a conviction that this wasn't right. And he also, at that time, became familiar with a group of Dominican monks that had come over, and they were always, you know, crying out against slavery, speaking out against it. And so he started to be influenced by these other, you know, voices around him and other perspectives. And so by this time he moved over to Cuba, and he was fully a priest at this point. He had, you know, ditched the whole plantation owner, you know, colonist life, and he was full-time in service to God. And in 1514, as he was preparing a sermon, he was struck by what the scriptures said, quote, "realizing there can be no true prayer and public worship without the outward exercise of justice." In other words, he saw that he was a total hypocrite, and that he, you know, the way he'd been treating the Indians, the way he'd been viewing things, was totally hypocritical and totally contrary to what the scriptures taught and to what, you know, the heart of God was. And so he realized he needed to make a change. And so he basically joined with the Dominicans because he had been so influenced by their perspective on towards slavery. And so he began speaking out against slavery with them. Eventually, he became the strongest advocate for Indian rights in the New World. Not only that, but he placed high priority on evangelism, and so for many years, he ended up traveling around Central America doing missionary work. In one instance, he was actually able to convince a chief, an Indian chief who had been threatening the colonists, to lay down his arms and have the whole tribe baptized. So it was this really remarkable instance. So he really was a peacemaker. God used him in that capacity. To a large extent, but, you know, interestingly, his biggest, I think his biggest problem, his biggest adversary were the other colonists. You know, they were very arrogant and very defiant of him because he was trying to improve the lot of the Indians and trying to help them and trying to create peace with them. And a lot of the colonists didn't like that. They're like, no, man, these people, they should be, like, you know, under, you know, submitted to us and, you know, subjugated to our rule and all that sort of a thing. And so because of that, because of the colonists, he really didn't have a lot of easy success. Like, I mean, among the Indians, things went great, but the colonists were just the biggest pain in the butt. So he ended up spending many years as a kind of ambassador between Spain and the New World, continuing to try to promote the cause of the Indians, desiring that they'd be given more rights, human rights, and freedoms. I will say he was a little bit naive in the way he viewed the Indians. I mean, it's very sweet because he really had a heart for them and loved them, but this is how he described them. God created these simple people without evil and without guile. Like, really? So, I don't know what... You know, sometimes you think with these guys, it's like the Catholics, it's like, it says they were reading the Bible, but I'm like, what Bible were they reading? Were they mostly reading the church fathers and commentaries on the Bible? They must have been, because it's like, how can you say that they were without evil? When it says very clearly, there's no one righteous, no, not one. But anyway, They are most obedient and faithful to their natural lords and to the Christians whom they serve. They are most submissive, patient, peaceful, and virtuous. They neither possess nor desire to possess worldly wealth. Surely these people would be the most blessed in the world if only they worship the true God. Okay, so they weren't all exactly that way, and, you know, they're coming in and killing people and, you know, cannibalizing and whatever else, you know, but it's a nice thought, and like I said, I think it's cool because at least what you see in that is that he loved them and he treated them, he gave them a sense of respect and dignity, that they were, you know, they were good, kind people that were very, you know, virtuous and all that stuff. You know, he gave them, like I said, a little bit more love and care than anybody else was at that time. So, when he was 70 years old, he was named bishop of a church in Chiapas in Mexico. And, you know, I think Chiapas today is a pretty impoverished area, right? It's a really, I think it's an economically low, struggling area of Mexico. And it's interesting because even way back in the 1500s, it was the same. It was one of the most impoverished areas of Mexico even back then. And he chose to go and be the bishop there instead of a opportunity he had in a more prestigious location where it would have been a little bit easier. And I thought that really speaks to his heart. You know, here he is, a 70-year-old man, and you'd think he'd want to just kind of semi-retire and take a, you know, easier road, but he chose instead to go to the poverty-stricken area and minister in a more difficult setting. So, you know, pretty cool guy. This ended up being one of the hardest times in his life. The plantation owners there, they blamed him for a lot of the laws that were being enacted that gave rights to the Mexican people. They're like, oh, you're that Las Casas guy. You're the one who's been, like, getting all these laws put in place that are messing with our, you know, our plantation operation and all that stuff. And so he was probably, I don't know if he was responsible for all of them, but he was responsible for a lot of this because he did have a lot of laws enacted. And so the plantation owners hated him. Not only that, but when he told his priests that they could not forgive the sins of any of the colonists that broke the law, many of them rebelled against him, which is kind of crazy. Even his own priests were like, they sided with the colonists. And they're like, you can't make them do that. You know, and so...
Wait, what was it? The priests were on for what?
The priests could not... I know, this is Catholic. So the priests were not allowed to forgive the sins of any of the colonists that broke the laws concerning Indian rights, you know, that mistreated Indians. He's like, you can't just let them off the hook. And the priests got upset about that because they sided with the colonists. And so they're like, heck no. So he had priests rebelling against him. He had the, you know, colonists. So like I said, I mean, kind of unexpected that those were like his greatest enemies were his own. And, you know, the Indian people were the ones that were more, you know, responsive and that he connected with. And so after only 3 years in Chiapas, he was frustrated and discouraged. He went back home to Spain, figuring he could fight the humanitarian cause much more effectively on the home front. So he never ended up returning to the New World. He died back in Spain. And so today it is said that he is still remembered as one of Christendom's greatest humanitarian missionaries. So he did a lot of practical service in ministry, for sure. So that's him. And then we have Francis Xavier. Another Spaniard born into the family of a Spanish noble. He grew up in a castle, so very well off, obviously.
Is that Dracula?
Hmm?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I know. It's just like the scene from the Indiana Jones, the Temple of Doom. You know, they pulled that part out. It's so gross. I hate that one. Anyway,
this.
What is not? Oh, you're a guy. I just thought it's so terrible. It must have been Sean Connery in the third one.
He got the
ew.
He got. Oh man, that's a good one.
Oh man.
Great.
Anyways.
Yeah. Well, that's one.
Dude, Last Crusade, and Sean Connery. Come on, you can't top him. Anyway, all right. So he went to the University of Paris.
I like the skull one, the alien
yes,
skull one. That was my favorite.
That was so. Halfway through,
I'm totally
I was like,
joking. I'm totally joking.
I know. Halfway through, like, is this about aliens? I don't even want to watch this. Like, this is about aliens. Oh my gosh, I'm so mad.
It's so funny. That was the best one for sure. Yeah. And the script was great.
Oh, yeah, bringing in all the old actors. Okay, anyways, so Francis Xavier went to University of Paris and he studied philosophy and theology. And he met up with some Protestants at this time, and actually he was very much impressed with them and leaning towards the Protestant faith, and that's probably what it would have happened. He would have gone that direction if he had not also met Ignatius of Loyola at that time. And we'll talk about Loyola in a few minutes, you know, because he was the founder of the Jesuit order. And it was because of Loyola's influence that Xavier not only rejected the Protestant faith, but even a lucrative career in the Catholic Church, and decided instead to follow Loyola's teachings of poverty and celibacy. And so from now on, his heart was to spread the Catholic faith at all costs, no matter what that meant. And so the call to missions for Xavier came in a rather weird way. He was basically, there was another man who was supposed to go and serve as a missionary to India, and he got super sick. And so they asked Francis Xavier to go instead. It's almost like he got called into sub for the day, but instead he got subbed out onto the mission field. So it's like, okay, I'll go. And so within 24 hours, literally, he was off to India. I was like, wow, that really is. It's like being a substitute teacher. I remember because I did that. So he heads off on 24 hours notice, goes to India, lands at the port of Goa in 1542, and finds all kinds of, you know, secular European influence, a lot of moral corruption that really bothered him. And he wasn't into a lot of the westernization that foreigners were bringing about. Like I said, you know, some of these conquistadores and some of the colonists and some of the people that were going out, they were bringing a lot of corruption. They were bringing, you know, they were bringing a lot of violence, and, you know, the way that they treated the native peoples of these different countries and stuff. And they were just, you know, mistreating them and taking advantage. They were very greedy. And so a lot of the stuff he saw really grieved him. And so he instead sought to try and really connect with the people instead of trying to be a lord over them or, you know, look down on them arrogantly. He wanted to meet them on their level and minister to them. And so he soon discovered reaching out to the children would be the key to really reaching this society, because kids were naturally more open. They were the most open. They were the most likely to receive the teachings of the church and the Bible on some level. But remember, this is Catholic missions. And so they did a lot of teaching the church. And this is what the church says and what our church fathers say. And so this ministry to children became kind of the trademark of his ministry. He once said, "Give me the children until they are 7 years old and anyone can have them afterwards." It's like, okay, that sounds like brainwash, but we'll just move on. Anyway, but it's kind of true, you know. It's like, if I could train them, you know, from the time they're young, you know, then they'll be solid, they'll be set. And so, like I said, he ministered to kids there for a little while. He got tired of living in Goa on the coast. I think he just got tired of the colonists and a lot of the Western ways. And so he moved south to a new region of India that was primarily, it was very strongly Hindu. And of course, everything in Hinduism depends on caste, right? Your social status. And so Xavier didn't really get a chance to penetrate the upper castes of society, but he did connect with a lot of the lower caste folks. Particularly a group called the Paravas. And he ended up getting this huge response from them for mass baptism. In fact, Xavier often baptized so many people that he could hardly move his arms by the end of the day. So, I mean, he's just like, you know, like a baptism factory there. They're like lemmings just running into the water, and then he just baptized them all. So, but that's, you know, that's a Catholic kind of a thing, the mass baptism. Like, let's just get them all in, you know, get them all sealed into the church here, and then move on. And so, that's what he did. But there were, you know, obstacles. It wasn't, like, so easy. It wasn't like everybody just embraced him with open arms. For one thing, of course, you have to wonder about the sincerity of these conversions. Did these people really know what they were doing? A lot of them got saved for social advancement and other purposes, because especially with the lower caste people, they're like, well, it can't get any worse than where I am now. You know, if I, you know, join up with these guys, these Westerners, you know, it'll somehow give me a foot in the door and I'll be able to move up the ladder a little bit. So he had that going on. Not only that, but again, there were supposedly Christian European people in the area, some soldiers and different folks that were there that set horrible examples for the people and that got, you know, just sent a confused message, because it was like, well, Xavier, you're a Christian, but so are those guys over there, and look what they're doing, you know? Like I said, some of the colonists that would just claim the name of Christ but not really have anything to do with the things of God. And so that was a confusing message that was being sent out. And he also had a lot of Hindus in the higher castes that began to feel threatened by Xavier's work, especially because they thought, well, what are you trying to do among the lower classes? Are you going to cause an insurrection or something? What's all this about? And so some of the higher caste Hindus were, you know, would threaten his life. I mean, he was shot at with arrows. All kinds of stuff happened to him, so his life was in danger. But throughout all of this, he just carried on. He kept pressing on. He continued focusing on ministering to children. He found that they were very receptive to his teaching. And he found that they could be his little evangelists. And so they would go out and, you know, he'd send them out as like little iconoclasts, going out and destroying the deities in their families' homes and stuff like that. It's like, I don't know how well that went over, but... So, you know, there was fruit on some level there, especially among the kids. But Xavier's ministry was, like I said, definitely very Catholic, which meant that the emphasis was on religion. It was on ritual, not necessarily a relationship with Jesus. The church services were very ritualistic, very repetitious. He really only taught the people the Catholic Church's doctrine and teachings, not really the basics of the gospel. And, you know, I've heard that from many Catholic people, that that happens. They've never heard the gospel, even though they've been in church for years, you know. They've never connected those dots, you know. It just hasn't been presented in that way. So I want to read this quote. This is what he said about his ministry, just to give you an idea. This is from Jerusalem Dear and Jaya Missions textbook that I use for the missionary biographies class. Says, Xavier's evangelism in India was superficial at best. Whether the children and adults who were baptized even knew the most fundamental truths of Christianity is doubtful. Church services were ritualistic and repetitious. Xavier's own account would indicate this. And here's what he said. This is like his diary. On Sundays, I assemble all the people, men and women, young and old, and get them to repeat the prayers in their language. They take much pleasure in doing so and come to the meetings gladly. I give out the first commandment, which they repeat, and then we all say together, Jesus Christ, Son of God, grant us grace to love thee above all things. When we have asked for this grace, we recite the Paternoster, the Our Father, together, and then cry with one accord, Holy Mary, Mother of Jesus Christ, obtain for us grace from thy Son to enable us to keep the first commandment. Next we say Ave Maria, and we proceed in the same manner through each of the remaining nine commandments. Can you imagine that? That would be... I mean, you just take forever, you know, you just keep repeating Hail Mary, da-da-da.
The first commandment, which says there shall be no other gods before me.
Yeah, interesting.
Cool.
I know, huh? It's just, yeah. We're not connecting the dots here. Oh, that's great. Good point. And just as we say 12 Our Fathers and 12 Ave Marias in honor of the 12 articles of the Creed, so we say 10 Paternosters, 10 Our Fathers and Aves in honor of the 10 Commandments, asking God to give us grace and keep them well. I mean, it was just so, it's just all, and then just basically imitate whatever he said.
Do you think, like, was there ever a point where reading Isaiah saying, like, I hate your traditions and your...
I know. Yeah, urbane repetition, all
yeah,
that stuff.
Yeah.
That's what's... I know, but, you know, I mean, even, yeah, go back to, like, the Middle Ages, it's like, gosh, those guys who read the Bible, I mean, like, how... I think because they depended so much on what the church fathers said and didn't go to the Word themselves that often. I mean, I think they probably read some of the Bible, but... You know, then you had other people, like, remember I was telling you guys about Menno Simons, you know, who was part of the Anabaptists and became the Mennonites, and how he said he was told that if he read the Bible for himself, he would be misled. It's like, no, you need to get your guidance from, you know, and so I think that just kind of, you know, kept a lot of people, not all, but it kept a lot of them from thinking for themselves and making that connection, like, wait a second, you know,
yeah,
there's something wrong here.
Like a weak faith, you know, because it's so... It's like grace is so easy to have, you know. God's grace is a gift, but it's like, oh, are you sure? Are you sure that I'm
saved,
you know?
Yeah.
I think a lot of that, because I have a lot of, like, Catholic family.
Yeah,
you know. And they're always like, well, we have to do something. It's like,
it's too
well,
easy.
You don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
God paid it all for you.
So yeah.
I think,
it
you
is.
Know, it's that mindset of just having faith. By faith, you're justified by faith alone. And it's like, you know, I have to do something.
Yeah.
I have to pray this much. I think it's not going to get you into heaven.
I think it makes people feel better, like they accomplished something. You know, like, you know, I'm sure that's what he was thinking when he wrote this. Like, I've accomplished something. I've gotten these people, you know, all on board, and so you feel like, because that's what man wants to do. We want to achieve. You know, grace is too easy. It's like that can't be right. You know, that's not. You know, it's suspicious. You know. When we want to just work and feel like we earned it, and I think that's I mean, those are great points, guys. I'm glad you know. Mention that. So that's, you know, where Xavier was at. You know, he's basically just teaching them the formulas and the rituals. But he was helpful in the sense that he was a trailblazer, and he laid a foundation for future generations. Interestingly, La Tourette says that the Paravas remained Christians, and in the 20th century they were still bulwarks of the Roman Catholic Church, which is amazing. So there's a strong Roman Catholic presence there in the south of India, as still, you know, for 400 years after his time. That was still there. And like I said, that would lay at least a foundation so that there'd be a familiarity with things of God once the Protestants came through and wanted to actually bring the Bible along, you know. So God can use anything, and God is, you know, he's not limited, and he could save people from ritual, you know, and bring them into relationship. So he left India in 1545. He headed for the Orient. He stopped to minister along the way and eventually arrived in Japan in 1549, which was actually an ideal location for missions in that day and age, because Japan was going through a lot of political instability in the mid-1500s. Buddhism was on the decline, and so their doors were wide open for the Christian faith. And so pretty soon Xavier had a decent-sized church developing. And as the first missionary to Japan, this was quite an accomplishment. In fact, it's kind of neat because years and years later, when the Protestants finally came on the scene, they found 100,000 Christians living in the Nagasaki area that were probably the result of Xavier's ministry. Like I said, it had paved the way and given people a familiarity. So, that, you know, it made the work that much easier for the Protestants when they came through 200 years later, you know. It was said of him that few missionaries of any religion have made so notable a record. But he desired to press on. He actually made plans to go to China, but sadly that never happened. He died before he could go there. Others would have to follow in his footsteps, like this guy, Matthew Ritchie. He was actually born the year that Francis Xavier died, and he really was kind of the man of the hour for the Catholic faith to bring Christianity to China and take Xavier's place and do what he had wanted to do. In fact, it was said that Matthew Ritchie became and has ever remained the most respected foreign figure in Chinese literature, who was most responsible for that breakthrough. Which is, you know, pretty remarkable.
In characters or in English literature?
No, I think, just foreign figure in their history, I assume. You know, it says Chinese literature. I'm assuming that would mean, like, in their history and stuff like that, or maybe they just know about him.
Interesting.
I don't know. I'm not sure exactly what that, you know, means, but... So he was born into the family of an Italian aristocrat. Interesting how all these guys came from upper-class families, you know, and they chose instead lives of poverty and, you know, ministry and hardship and stuff. It's kind of cool. He was sent to Rome to study law, but while he was there, he, you know, got influenced by the Jesuits, and so he decided after 3 years to join with them. And his dad was horrified. He tried to go to Rome to stop his son, but he got super sick when he was on the way, and so he took it as a sign from God that he needed to just let his son go. So he just turned around and went home. So it's kind of like, wow, I mean, how often does that happen? But, you know, back then, people were a lot more aware of, you know, spiritual things in a sense, in terms of letting, and wanting God to, you know, control their lives and stuff like that. There is an aspect of that that's like, man, we lost that, unfortunately. Now, Ritchie did continue to excel in his studies. He became a leading mathematician. He became very learned in several subjects, and that eventually would open up doors of communication with the Chinese people. But when he first went on the mission field as a Jesuit missionary, he was assigned to serve in India. That was not his first choice, but that's where he went first. After some time, however, he was able to enter China, which is what he really wanted to do, I presume, and... He was given, and in doing so, he was given an opportunity that most foreigners were not given in that day. China, as you guys might know over the centuries, they've had periods where they would be a little bit open to Western influence, but generally very guarded and closed off and suspicious of Western influence. And, you know, maybe they had a good point, a good reason for that, you know. But at that time, China was in a period of becoming closed off. And so for Ritchie to be able to gain access and favor there was a really big deal. And like I said, that most foreigners did not have that privilege or that opportunity. But because he was so well-educated and so familiar with so many different subjects, like math, astronomy, geography, all of those kinds of things, that opened doors for him. Because when the Chinese government and the upper classes, when they heard about him, they were like, wait a minute, we want this guy to come and teach us some things about, so we can learn at least about what's going on in Western sciences and stuff like that. And so I like that, how God used, you know, his secular learning for his own purposes and plans, which God can definitely do with anyone. And so Ritchie was not just allowed to enter the country, but he was invited to come and live near the royal court, which was unheard of. So the Chinese appreciated the Western learning that he brought, but his goal was not just to bring Western education to them and to teach them about science and stuff. his ultimate goal was evangelization, was to teach them the Christian faith. And so he decided to become all things to all men, which from his perspective meant taking the form of a Buddhist monk, even to the point of like shaving his head and dressing like them. And then later he wanted to reach the Confucian scholars, and so he started dressing like them so he could target the Chinese intelligentsia. And so the whole goal was to bring, you know, he, what he wanted to do, what he was trying to do was bring Christianity into a cultural context and try to make it compatible or make it understandable, palatable to the people. But this was a very controversial approach, and he took a lot of heat from it for this, especially from other orders like the Dominicans and the Franciscans. They're like, those Jesuits, man, look at them. They're like, you know, compromise and all this stuff. And so that's what a lot of them believed, that he was compromising the purity of the Christian faith to try to connect with the people. And in some ways, honestly, I think they were right, because Ritchie was identifying not just with the culture, he was identifying with different religions. And I think that's where there's got to be careful. You know, we're going to look later at Hudson Taylor, who you guys might be familiar with, in Protestant missions, and see how he became all things to all men culturally without, you know, in any way trying to link himself with the religions of the of China. You know, he wasn't trying to go there. But Ritchie, so I think Ritchie kind of clouded the issue a little bit by identifying with the Confucians and identifying with the Buddhist monks. It was kind of like, okay, wait a minute, what do you teach? And so he also, you know, there were other things he did that probably conflicted with a lot of the other orders as well. He didn't insist on stopping rituals like ancestor worship. He kind of just let some things slide, and it's like, well, you're not sending a very clear message here. And so he didn't follow the accepted doctrine, which was tabula rasa, clean slate. That was the general approach to Catholic missions, was to remove all non-Christian beliefs, wipe them out, and then reintroduce Christian principles. And so that was definitely very much against the grain in his day. But in spite of the opposition, some of the questionable methods that he used, he did make a great impact on the upper classes. And you do have to appreciate the fact that at least he was trying to connect with the people instead of acting like he was, you know, distinct from them or better than them or anything like that. He was trying to connect with the people. So you can see his heart there. And he did make an impact. In fact, even though he didn't have very many converts, the people that did get converted were so important that their influence carried on for several generations. And so, in spite of what his critics said, he was a Roman Catholic through and through. He was true to the Catholic faith until his death. And so, that is Matthew Ritchie. So, missions, you could say, was a somewhat fruitful area of reform and spiritual awakening in the Catholic Church. But there were others who wanted to impact the church from within back home in Europe. And so I'm going to just run through quickly a couple other people back home who brought about reform, kind of like in similar ways to the mystics of earlier generations. Those would be Teresa of Avila, for one. Considered probably the most famous and well-loved woman in Spanish history. She was born in Avila, Spain, obviously. Probably figure that out for yourselves. She was one of 10 kids, and she was very devoted to God from an early age. In fact, when she was only 7 years old, she and her brother ran away from home to go to the enemy territory of the Moors, which were the Muslims that lived in the south of Spain there, and go and be beheaded for Christ. I was like, well, that's pretty radical for a seven-year-old. Let's go die! You know, kind of, wow. So she has this death wish, takes her brother with her. But, you know, this always happens when you try to run away from home. Eventually something goes wrong, you know. And so their uncle saw them, like, on the outskirts of town, leaving the village. He's like, what the heck are they doing? And so he went and caught them and brought them home. And again, remember, she's like seven, and I don't know how old her brother was, but kind of wild that they wanted to just run off and get killed. So there's that radical kind of fanatical religiosity.
You'll find two witnesses in the streets.
Revelation. Oh, yeah. And so, but this devotion she had spiritually kind of faded from her life as she became a teenager. Oh, those crazy teenagers, you know. And she started to get really distracted by the cares of the world and stuff, and, you know, wanting to look nice and meet guys and all that sort of thing. But not in the same way. It's not like how it is today, but get married, all those kind of things. But when her mom died, she was 15 years old, and that kind of dramatically changed everything and gave her like a wake-up call. She was so distraught over her mom's death, her dad didn't know what to do with her. As you can probably imagine, what man is good with a crying woman? You know, it's always an awkward experience, right? So he did not know what to do with his teenage basket case daughter, like, oh, she's all hormonal and crazy. So he sent her off to the Augustinian nuns for guidance. Like, I'm going to send you to go hang out with some women for a while in this convent. And so she was so impressed by the nuns and so impacted by them that she eventually ran away from home again when she was older. She really loved running away from home, apparently, and joined the Carmelite order. Which was a good place for her to be in a way, but spiritually she just wasn't connecting the dots. In fact, she would say that she was really kind of dead spiritually. And so for 18 years, she struggled with how to really commune with and connect with God. I mean, talk about wilderness experience, you know? We think we go through dry seasons in our walk. It's like 18 years, that's like, whoa, that's pretty, you know, pretty nuts. So finally, when she was 39 years old, she had probably, I guess you would say, a conversion experience where she really realized what Jesus had done for her. And from this time, she was totally transformed. There was a new zeal, a new joy, freedom, passion in her life, desire for purity and service. And so she became a reformer and founder of various convents in Spain, starting in 1560. And so this was a very, you know, necessary work. Like I said, it was important as part of the Catholic Reformation, the Counter-Reformation, you know, trying to bring revival into the church. But of course, we do want to keep in mind that she definitely had that Catholic mentality that these other guys had. I mean, here's a statement that was made by her biographer. A vision of the place destined for her in hell in case she was unfaithful to grace determined her to seek a more perfect life. It's like, okay, there's that works thing again. Like, man, I'm gonna be fried if I don't do more. You know, if I don't go out and reform more convents. So they kind of have that mentality of work still that was prompting them. Sad.
This isn't Mother Teresa, is it?
No. I know somebody asked me that actually the other day. I'm like, no, different one. No, Mother Teresa's modern.
Yeah.
So. Support and reform was very slow in coming for her, but when it did come through, her convents were so blessed and they grew so much and were so successful that in 1567 she was told that would be her main duty as a nun. I want you to, you know, they told her, the people over her, they said, we want you to go and just reform convents, establish, you know, convents and get them cranking, you know, going the right direction here. And so that became her life work for the next 15 years till she died in 1582. However, as much as her reformed convents were significant in terms of reforming the church, her writings were what were most influential over the long haul. Not only for the church, but for Spanish history in general. In fact, you know, I was a Spanish major in college, that's what my degree is in, and so when we were studying Spanish literature, I actually had to read a bunch of stuff by Teresa of Avila because, you know, she's a significant figure in their literature. So, kind of cool. Her most significant works were her autobiography, which was called The Way of Perfection, another work called The Interior Castle, which is considered to be of equal importance with the Confessions of St. Augustine. Historically speaking, you know, people have compared it or put the two on the same level, which is quite, you know, that's quite a statement. One quote from her, I liked this one. She said, "God would speak to many hearts, but the world makes too much noise." And so, you know, obviously she was a big advocate for, you know, separating yourself from the things of the world and coming away, coming apart, and really devoting your life to God, really focusing on your prayer life. And a lot of her writings did deal with the prayer life. And so, as a result, a lot of times she's associated with the mystics because that was a big focus of her writings. The Interior Castle, that's what that's about. It's like she kind of draws an analogy with the human soul being like a castle and how you want to let God into every room in the castle in your heart and that kind of a thing. So, it's got that mystical kind of, you know, go deeper with the things of God, go deeper in relationship with Him, become one with God and with Christ and all that sort of thing. So, that is Teresa of Avila. And then we have Brother Lawrence.
Yeah.
You know him? Yeah, all right. Brother Lawrence is awesome. His writings were compiled into a classic, a literary classic called The Practice of the Presence of God, which isn't just a Catholic book. It's actually sold in, I've seen it in all kinds of Christian bookstores and stuff. I think it's probably in our bookstore, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, he has a lot of really solid stuff to say.
that's really his main contribution to the revival in Catholic spirituality. Kind of like Thomas A. Kempis, who wrote The Imitation of Christ, you know, that's the one thing that they were known for. But that one thing is enough, you know, I mean, that's something that has endured through the ages. Brother Lawrence was born into a poor peasant family in France. He joined the army to try to get out of poverty. He had a spiritual experience while he was in there, at which time he first understood the grace and the sovereignty of God. And so when he was, you know, he was still a soldier, and then he went into battle and was injured. It ended his military career. And so because he had been growing so much in his relationship with God, he decided he wanted to join a Carmelite monastery. So the male version of the monastery of the Carmelites, which is what Teresa was as well. So there he was assigned to work in the monastery kitchen, and one of the cardinals, not like the Arizona cardinals, the cardinals were like the, you know, they'd be like the abbots, the leadership over the, you know, just they were a higher rank in the Catholic Church. So there was a cardinal that noticed Brother Lawrence and noticed that this, you know, this little humble monk had a lot of wisdom, and he was just like, wow, this guy's kind of cool. He had conversations with him and really just enjoyed talking to him. And so the cardinal came to Lawrence, and he held 4 interviews and faithfully recorded everything. And it was the cardinal, that particular man, who later contributed the little information that we have on the life of Brother Lawrence. We don't really know a lot about him personally, but this cardinal wrote down some biographical information. In addition, all of these pages of thoughts and ideas, as well as the 4 interviews with the cardinal, were found in Brother Lawrence's personal belongings, and they were all collected into the Practice of the Presence of God. So it's kind of a series of a lot of things. It's the interviews with the cardinal, and then a lot of his own thoughts and writings that he just had in his possession. So the really significant thing about Brother Lawrence's writings, as historians have said, is that more than any other of his day, Brother Lawrence understood the holiness available within the common business of life. And so he talks a lot about the fact that any duty, any task you have, no matter how mundane or how silly it may seem, it can all be an instrument of God's love. And so what made any task secular or sacred was simply the motivation behind it. You know, it really, that was really what mattered, was the motivation and the heart behind it. You know, it's worldly if you're doing it for yourself, but it can be sacred if you're doing it under the Lord. And really, that's almost what Luther taught, you know? Remember when Luther was talking about, when Luther was talking about the monastic life, and how that wasn't necessarily any more sacred than living your life for God out in the normal world, you know? Remember he was saying, like, any job, any occupation could be used for the glory of God? That's essentially what Brother Lawrence was saying. Any profession, anything you do, any activity can be considered ministry unto the Lord. And so I just want to read a couple of samples of what he said, just to get an idea of this. Nor is it needful that we should have great things to do. We can do little things for God. I turn the cake frying in the pan for the love of God, and that being done, if there's nothing else to call me, I prostrate myself and worship before him who has given me grace to work. Afterwards, I rise happier than a king. It is enough for me to pick up but a straw from the ground for the love of God. Men invent means and methods of coming at God's love, and they learn rules and set up devices to remind them of that love, and it seems like a world of trouble to bring oneself into the consciousness of God's presence. It might be so simple. Is it not quicker and easier just to do our common business wholly for the love of God? Yeah, it is. You know, I mean, he's very sound, and his, you know, even just his logic and what he says is like, yeah, that totally makes sense. That resonates. You can do anything for the Lord, anything unto God, anything for the glory of God. And so I just think what a precious man and a sweet, you know, sweet guy that was just in humility lived his life for the Lord, and God, you know, has used his writings for centuries. I'm sure he'd be shocked to hear, like, just how far his writings have gone historically. So, again, even though this concept was expressed by guys like Luther, you know, prior to this, this was a new concept within the Catholic Church, and that explains the significance, because he really did a lot to bring, you know, a fresh perspective towards serving God into the church at that time. So, why don't we go ahead and take a break, and then we'll finish up with a couple more people, and yeah, we'll get that done. So, yes, take your break now. We're moving along. We're good.
Presence of God.
Knock it out. What I must do quickly. Okay. Okay, so anyway, never mind. Sorry.
It sounds like a brave art. I mean, I just think
that's from the Bible.
What I must do, do. Oh, yeah,
do,
okay.
Yeah, this is some kind of brave artist.
It still sounds.
Freedom! Okay. Anyways. Shapes. Oh, that's awesome.
What is that? Pretty manly?
I don't know.
Jesus, oh,
it's a totally manly moment.
Oh
my
gosh. I just remembered.
Alright, next we have Madame Guyon. And you could probably guess where she was from.
France?
Zimbabwe.
Just kidding.
Yes, France. She's French. Probably one of the greatest influences in spiritually awakening the church in her day. And she was actually a little bit more right on biblically. Like Brother Lawrence, her works have been used by Protestants and Catholics alike. And look at the time she lived. You know, she's like back with her. So obviously the scriptures were circulating a little bit more. She would have had probably more opportunity to actually read the Bible for herself, which would explain why she's a little more grounded. Also, she influenced a lot of other significant folks in the church, in the Catholic Church, especially a guy named Fenelon. His writings were pretty important. So, like I said, she was French. From a young age, she actually wanted to be a nun, but kind of like Teresa of Avila, she got caught up in worldliness during her teenage years. When she was only 16, her parents forced her to marry a 38-year-old man named Jacques Bouillon, poor thing. That's kind of... Yeah, that does. But, I mean, you know, back then that's what happened, but it would just be kind of, for her, it's like, oh, man, old geezer, you know. Of course, that's sort of close to my age, so I don't, anyway. But, you know, when you're 16, that's like, whoa, that's gnarly, all right? So she endured 12 years of a very difficult marriage, made worse by the fact that she had the mother-in-law from Gehenna, apparently. And so the marriage ended with Jacques' death and the death of two of her children as well. So, I mean, it was kind of a really hard, you know, hard life there for over a decade. She had to just push through all this. In the midst of all that time, not only did two of her kids die, and she just had a hard marriage, but when she was only 22, she was struck with smallpox, which basically destroyed her features, because, you know, smallpox could very often leave you with just a bunch of, you know, pock marks, you know, hence the name smallpox. And so she had once been just known for her beauty and all that sort of a thing, but now she had this humbling experience where she just looks, you know, kind of foul. And so, not only that, but it brought her to, you know, she was also at death's door while she was sick. I mean, it was a very scary time for her, and again, a very humbling experience. It was very weakening. But during this time, it was so hard, the Lord really met her, and she ended up giving her life to him. And really only the knowledge of his presence could pull her out of the depression that was on her from just like her life circumstances and the smallpox kind of being the last straw, you know. It was really only a relationship with God that sustained her and pulled her through that time. So she had always been inclined to spiritual things. And like I said, and so now that she had a wake-up call with the Lord and now an encounter with him, she threw herself wholeheartedly into the mystical life under the influence of former mystics, but also the tutelage of this prior, a monk. His name was Francois Lacombe. And so over a period of several years, she wrote about how she lived in the conscious presence of God, and it was really her closeness to the Lord, like I said, that enabled her to cope so well with the many trials that she had to work through. She eventually joined Lacombe in traveling around Europe, I presume after her husband died, and they began spreading their spiritual doctrines concerning mysticism, specifically something known as quietism. Quietism was Madame Guyon's special brand of mysticism. and this refers to, quote, the state of human inactivity while in fellowship with God when praying, reading, and meditating on the scriptures. So the goal was basically to enter into a state of complete quietness, hence the term quietism, before God, so as to be fully surrendered, so that He can have His way in the life of the believer. You know, kind of like Psalm 46:10, where it says, "Be still and know that I am God." That's kind of the concept there. Like, just be still, be in His presence, be yielded, and know He is God. Definitely not a bad thing, a wonderful thing to do. Probably something we should do more often because we are so distracted in our society and in this day and age. But They had some, she and Lacombe had some weird, bizarre practices in conjunction with this. They would spend hours together in silence, and apparently their spirits were communing with one another. Kind of weird. It's like, sounds like telepathy kind of a thing. They're like trying to do like, yeah, like, I don't know, send each other some special signal. Go get me a glass of water. I don't know, you know. Anyways, so they did this. So they were actually condemned as heretics and thrown in prison, although she had a lot of friends and support in high places to kind of help pull strings and get her out. So she actually ended up getting in prison several times over the course of her life. Finally, she was put under house arrest. And yet, in spite of the claim that she was so rebellious, she always protested this and said that she died submissive to the Catholic Church, from which she never had any intention of separating herself. She's like, I'm Catholic through and through. I just want to see spiritual death. I just want to see people really enter into full communion with God and full surrender. That's really the same heart that all the mystics had for the church. And so it just that hers looked a little unusual, and so she was suspicious. Or treated suspiciously, I guess I should say. And like I said, if you read her writings, it's clear to see that she's pretty well grounded. From what I've read of her, you know, I've read several quotes from her and writings and diary things, and it's just, she quotes scripture a lot in her writings. There's a lot of good things. I mean, she had some things that were obviously a little odd, but a lot of good stuff, too. She wrote an 18-volume commentary on the Bible, so she must have been actually reading the Bible. 9 volumes of letters, 4 volumes of poems and canticles, a 3-volume autobiography. But her smallest work was actually the best-known one, probably because it was the fastest to read. It was called The Short and Easy Method of Prayer, and that became kind of a history classic, I guess, a Christian history classic. And it explains Quietism really well, too. So that is Madame Guyon, and that brings us to our last guy, Ignatius of Loyola. Yes.
What was that painting of her 130 years later?
I don't know. Somebody just had a really good memory, and I guess they just. I mean, a lot of people just did that. They just did what they thought that person looked like, or they took descriptions of them from the time, you know, and tried to. Anyway, you get that with a lot of paintings, you know, that were done later. So, yeah, good question. All right, Ignatius of Loyola, our last guy. Now, he obviously is one of the most influential figures, not just in the Catholic Reformation of reviving the church spiritually, but in establishing the counter-Reformation aspect, you know, against the reformers. And so we'll see that as we go. Your book talks about his life pretty extensively, so I'm going to just hit the high points quickly. Ignatius was born into another one of these rich guys, these noble, wealthy Spanish families. He was sent to the court, to the royal court, to become a page, which would be like an errand boy. And he got just stuffed right into the life of the court. You know, it was just chasing women and gambling and, you know, got involved in, like, military exercise and stuff like that. In fact, that's what really began to draw him as a young man. So he ended up going into the army, served in a war against the French in 1521, but was badly injured, ended up having surgery, and during that time, it was like a 7-week period that he needed to recover. And so while he was convalescing, he's just laying there, and so he asked for someone to bring him romance novels to read. Now, this is not like romance novels today, you know, those cheesy, you know, like, I don't know, racy stories. So funny. You guys know, you know, romance novels, right? Like, that old ladies read. Like, my grandma used to read those, and I remember when I was a kid, she'd talk about how, oh, I like to read them for the historic content. You know, there's always a good story. And then I was like, okay. So I opened it, and I was like, holy. I was like, whoa. It's like so nasty. I was like, oh, gosh. It was like a rated R book. I was like, dang, grandma. So anyway.
I had a friend whose mom she had bookshelves. She loved them.
Yep.
Once I went over there, I was like, whoa, this is gnarly.
Yeah, I know.
She had them everywhere. She had shelves and shelves of these. And it's like some real swole dude on the cover.
Totally, yeah, this girl. Like,
it's like, girl, she's
with her dress ripped up to her thighs. Yeah. It's like, okay, come on. You know, it's just so over the top. I know. It's like, gosh, grandma, give yourself a heart attack here. Come on. So anyway. I'm just kidding. I mean, she's with Jesus now, but she's, yeah, I love her. She's the best. So anyway, I don't want to diss on her, but anyway, she was great. But she just read romance novels, and I thought, whoa, that's what I first thought when I was looking at this. I was like, Ignatius of Loyola read romance novels? That's kind of weird. But back then, a romance novel was totally something else. A romance then would have been like a medieval story of courage and, you know, fighting battles for the damsel in distress. And yeah, it was more of that, like an adventure story. So he's reading, you know, he wanted to read romance novels, but there wasn't anything available at the time. And so they're like, sorry, you know, wherever he was, I don't remember where he was in recovery, but all they had available were some spiritual books. And so he's like, okay, fine, I'll just read those. It's better than nothing and just sitting here being bored. So one of these books described the spiritual life as a life of holy chivalry. And he's like, oh, that's kind of cool. Maybe spiritual things aren't that bad, you know, because he's a military guy that's connected with him. And so during the rest of his convalescence, he started to undergo this spiritual transformation so that after he recovered in 1522, he said goodbye to his family, headed off on pilgrimage to Montserrat, eventually to Manresa. You guys read about this. During this time, he confessed his sins. He broke with his old life. He spent hours daily in prayer and lived for almost a year as a total bum, basically, as a beggar. Just basically, I guess, denying himself and not even... You know, to the point of not taking care of hygiene. He didn't cut his hair or his nails. He would, you know, kind of whip and beat himself. Again, he's trying to bring his flesh into submission. And so this was a time of radical transformation in his life where he said, the eyes of my understanding began to open. During this experience, he wrote a little book called Spiritual Exercises, which became a very influential devotional book in church history. So after this time, he decided to pursue a more thorough education, which he had never done before. And so he went back to school for the next 12 years. As a student, he was under suspicion of heresy. He was tried by the Spanish Inquisition more than once, but never convicted of anything. And during that time, he began to gather around him a lot of like-minded young men, including Francis Xavier. And in 1534, he and his little group of guys, they bound themselves to vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience to the church. But they didn't have an order to be bound to. You know, they wanted to do something different than the Franciscans and the Dominicans, the Carmelites, and all these other monks and nuns and stuff like that. And so in 1540, Pope Paul III gave approval to them to form a new order, which was called the Society of Jesus, or the Jesuits. And the Jesuits had many remarkable characteristics. They were very distinct in some ways from a lot of the other Catholic orders of monks and stuff. One of their main characteristics was their desire to be mobile and adaptable. And I think that came from his whole mentality of being like a soldier, you know, being a good soldier of Jesus Christ. This is what we do. We, you know, we go out on the field. We go out to the battle. We don't just stay and hide away in a monastery and stuff like that. And so they didn't really cloister themselves away. They didn't carry on a lot of the activities of the traditional orders. They like I said, they were out active. They wanted to just be engaged in the world. And they said that they wanted to be apostles, quote, ready to live in any part of the world where there was hope of God's greater glory and the good of souls. And so that explains the great missionary vision that they had. The Dominicans and Franciscans were also missionaries, but the Jesuits were very proactive in that particular area, and they were some of the most significant missionaries, as we've talked about, from Catholicism. Their other most prominent characteristic probably was their unswerving obedience to the Pope. They saw him as, you know, the representative, the voice of God himself. And so they were definitely zealots in that sense. They defended the Church and the Pope at all costs, not always in a very calm, peaceful way either. And so that explains why they were so aggressive towards the Protestants. And maybe because of that, and also just the fact that the Jesuits had that kind of militaristic mindset, a lot of people assumed that Ignatius himself was this very cold, calculated, iron-willed man who was really harsh. And yet, one of his closest associates describes him this way. He said, Ignatius was always rather inclined toward love. Moreover, he seemed all love, and because of that, he was universally loved by all. There was no one in the society who did not have much great love for him and did not consider himself much loved by him. So he was just a big old teddy bear. What a, you know, warm, fuzzy little guy. And so it's no wonder that little society held together so well, that he was able to sway, you know, like I was saying, you know, some of them would be leaning towards the Protestant faith, but he had he was so engaging and cared so much that he was able to bring a lot of guys together and rally around him. And so the Jesuits and their great leader, Ignatius of Loyola, became a very significant force in the counter-reformation of the Catholic Church, because they didn't just go out to evangelize and bring reform spiritually from within the Church, but they also supported and protected Catholicism's belief system against people like the Protestants. And You know, so there was, you know, there was a sincerity there. You read about Ignatius, you realize he was very sincere, but just sincerely wrong, unfortunately, in a lot of his beliefs and things like that. But, you know, in a sense, you kind of just, like, have to appreciate, you know, that, okay, he was trying to serve God. It's just, yeah, anyway, just kind of unfortunate. This is just how it is. This is the Catholic, you know, again, this is the Catholic Church, so we just have to take it all with a grain of salt. So, even though it was conceived as a call of God, the work of Ignatius really brings us back to that more practical and even political side of the Counter-Reformation, because, you know, others might have wanted to just bring reform within the church spiritually, but the Jesuits didn't want just spiritual reform. They actually wanted to counter the reformers. They wanted to aggressively defend the Pope and protect the church. And so, again, there was a political aspect to the Counter-Reformation that we're going to look at next. It kind of segues into that. So, like I said at the beginning, the Catholic Church was very slow in responding to the reformers, and a lot of that had to do with world politics at that time. The heart of the issue had to do with, I mean, of course, there was the whole aspect of, well, maybe the reformers will just die out. Maybe this is just a little, like I said, a flash in the pan. It's just a little trendy thing that's going to die out. There was that aspect, but really, the heart of the issue, once it was clear that the reformers were here to stay, that they really meant business, and that, you know, a lot of people saw the need for reform in a radical sense, the heart of the issue became at that point how to go about calling a church council. Because remember, the reformers originally wanted just what their name signifies. They wanted reform. And so we always want to remember that about the reformers. They weren't, like I said last week, they weren't hotheads that just came out and were like, forget the church, we're all breaking away. And, you know, they weren't initially like that. You know, initially, Luther, Calvin, all these guys, they wanted to see reform. They wanted change to happen in the church. They wanted to stay unified. They wanted everybody to stay together on the same page. It's just that as time went on, they realized that wasn't going to happen. As time went on, they became a little bit more militant and then became Protestants, breaking away and protesting, right? But initially, the reformers wanted reform. And so early on, Luther actually called for some kind of a powwow, like some kind of a meeting between leaders on both sides of the issue to try to bring reconciliation. But the Pope at the time hesitated because he remembered past catastrophes at some of these church councils. The Council of Constance had been a big blow to the church. It really depleted the power of the church. You might remember that was the church council where nations were officially acknowledged and formed. And so you see a kind of shifting in society where people were identifying themselves nationally and politically in one sense, and then spiritually in another sense, they were kind of dividing their loyalties, right? So, you know, the Pope remembered that sometimes the church councils in the past didn't really go the church's way. And so there was a sense of hesitation there. They were a little bit gun-shy, church leaders were. They also knew that if the German princes had anything to do with it, they would side with Luther, and it would turn into this whole disaster and turn into a big military, but also political mess. Not only that, but it just so happened that during this time, as Luther's calling for a council, calling for a meeting, there was a bunch of other drama going on between Rome and France, so they're just distracted by all of these other issues. I mean, it was just so multi-layered. The church, you know, like I said, the church had ruled society, so they were, like, kind of controlling and had their hand in all these different nations and all these different issues, and so it was easy to get distracted from really what ended up being the major one. You know, the major issue was the reformers, but they were like, yeah, yeah, we'll get to that eventually. We're going to deal with these other things first. And so, we don't actually read about a major response to the call for reform until the time of Pope Paul III, who I put up on the board there, in the mid-1530s. And he realized that on some level the reformers were right, that things did need to change in the church. So good for him. He made a clean sweep in the Council of Cardinals. He brought in these pro-reform guys who called for the papacy and called for the cardinals to stop flirting with the world and being so carnal and being so secular. One guy even desired to have full reconciliation with the reformers and return to the faith of the disciples. So it was like, wow. I mean, there were some people that really were open to total radical transformation in the church, which is surprising. You wouldn't think that, but there were a few ultra pro-reform guys. And so some of the carnality, some of the impurity in the church was addressed during this time. Pope Paul did a good job with that. But they still hadn't gotten together with their reformers to really hash things out. They just didn't settle on any course of action because there was so much red tape and a lot of politics to work through. But finally, a church council was called, the very critical Council of Trent, from 1545 to 1563. So this was like an 18-year council. So they would just kind of meet and then break up for a while and reconvene later, and, you know, it went on for ages. And so that's great and all. Okay, yay, we finally have a church council. But remember, Luther had been calling for a council way back in like the 1520s and the 1530s, literally decades before this. But by now, you know, times have changed. The reformers had become, you know, a greater threat. They were starting to break away because nothing had happened. You know, there was no change. The church hadn't responded. And so it's like, okay, so we have to do our own thing. They've broken away and become Protestants, right? And so now, by now, there's no voice really strongly calling out to reunite with the reformers and let's kind of try to find a compromise here. And so instead, sadly, the Council of Trent revealed that the church had become much more militant in its stance toward the Protestants' version of reform. And so under Pope Paul III, the Catholic Church based their reform on just doing better what they were already doing. They were like, you know, at the end of the day, by now they were just irritated with the reformers. It's like, no, we're going to take a stand against this. And so they basically just stated their position that they held for centuries and centuries in a more clear and unified voice. You know, so it ended up, instead of being a time of bringing unity, it brought that much more distinction and separation. And so this is where the teachings of Thomas Aquinas, who I told you guys about a few weeks ago, were kind of pulled off the shelf and dusted off, and they realized, like, man, this guy, he articulates all of our teaching and all of our theology. This is what we believe. We're going to go with this. So they brought Thomas Aquinas into play. And as your book says, that means that the council's work was essentially medieval. Only the anger was new. And I think that sums it up very well, because they were bringing in a medieval theologian, Thomas Aquinas, and just basically regurgitating, restating all of his theology. In a very militant and a very aggressive posture towards the reformers, towards the Protestants. And so instead of being a time of reconciliation, like I said, the Council of Trent represents the epitome of the counter-reformation against the reformers. Since both Protestants and Catholics were essentially saying they were right, there could be no agreement. So from that point on, the church was split the way it is today. So this, you could say the Council of Trent is where we officially have the distinction between Catholic and Protestant come into existence, you know. And it was already in the making. We saw that last week. It was already starting to happen with the reformers as they broke off, but now it was official from the Catholic side as well. Like, yep, we're going our own separate ways here theologically. So that's kind of a, you know, again, the theological religious side, and then there's more to it than that, because this had to play itself out politically on the world scene. The modernization of Western Europe specifically, was naturally entwined with these developments in the church, because remember, politics and religion had been married to each other for over 1,000 years, right? You know, we're still the old Reformation era. I mean, this was all very fresh, and this was a very difficult transitionary period, because people were so used to everything in the church affecting everything politically, right? Everything in society was bound up in the church. And so, you know, if you make this decision at the council, it's got to play itself out somehow. You know, like, what's going to happen now? We have two churches? What does that mean? What does that mean for society? What does that mean for our culture? What does that mean for politics? How does this play out? And so if you divide Catholicism and Protestantism, it's going to have to play itself out somehow in different nations and territories. And so the question was, okay, so do we try to coexist with each other, or do we just pick a faith and apply it to our country or our territory, our land? You know, how are we gonna work this out? And that's an important, you know, this was a very, very important and critical question that Europe was trying to cope with and deal with at this time. And so, are you guys following? Are we okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so trying to coexist, have Protestants and Catholics in the same nation or in the same territory, was a very hard pill to swallow for the Western world, because we talked about last week how foreign the concept of religious coexistence would be for people coming out of the Middle Ages. Because, you know, during the Middle Ages, being united as an empire, being united as a nation, meant being united in faith, right? It was all one. Everybody, it was all, like I said, married. It was all united together. And so for people coming out of the Middle Ages still in this transitionary period of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, it seemed like it might be easier to just have like a Calvinist country over here and a Catholic country here and a Lutheran territory here. This would just be easier. And so it was still very us versus them. It was very divided. And that explains, you know, a lot of the aggression, a lot of the violence that happened during this time. It explains the militancy of groups like the Jesuits, who were so aggressive towards the Protestants. It explains the persecution under Bloody Mary, right? Queen Mary Tudor, who we talked about last week in England. You know, why she felt she had to go and execute all the Protestants, because they weren't of the faith that's going to keep us united, right? It really explains all of the major Protestant-Catholic wars that raged in Europe in the mid-late 1500s. They just didn't see how they could coexist, and so, you know, national wars were religious wars as well. Everything was tied in with each other, you know, and a lot of times people would take advantage of that. You know, they'd say they were doing this in the name of religion in order to try to go take another territory or another country over, right? It all would just kind of mesh together. So what happened was, you have all these battles going on. In Germany, you have the Lutheran princes and the Catholics. In France, you have the Huguenots, which would be the like Calvin, French Calvinists, and you have the Catholics. And then you've got in the Netherlands other Calvinists and Catholics going on. And so you got all these fights and battles and wars, not just in those three countries, but those were three of the major ones. And they all came to some form of peace agreement in which various territories throughout the nation or kingdom could name that particular area Catholic or Protestant as they desired. And that sounds nice. It's like, okay, they appeased each other. Like, okay, you guys are Catholic over there, we're Protestant over here. But it was still that same medieval mentality that the government and the church needed to rule society together and work in society together. It was just on a smaller scale, all right? It just wasn't like an overarching church that was ruling as like the Christian empire, over a whole huge Christian empire. It was just happening on a smaller level within nations and territories. So, with all that fragmentation, it was just a matter of time before everything fell apart because, you know, it just couldn't work. You know, everybody's just constant, there's just constant friction, constant tension, and it would lead to more war. I mean, they just weren't able to make it work like this. It was still just so divided and so tense. And so, like it or not, Europe would have to agree to religious coexistence. And so how that came about was, in 1555, the German Peace of Augsburg was signed. And this agreement was helpful, but it only gave rights to the Lutherans, while other groups like the Calvinists were still kind of marginalized and even oppressed. They weren't even allowed to have their say or have any opportunity to express themselves freely. You know, there was the opportunity for the Lutherans, the opportunity for the Catholics, but nobody else. And so, obviously, they got kind of upset about this. Like, man, you know, do we not have a right to meet and assemble together? Do we not have a right to worship God? And so you've got that going on. So they're upset. At the same time, the Lutherans and the Catholics continued to experience friction and tension. So really, it was only a matter of time before another war broke out, which it did in 1618, resulting in the 30 Years' War. 1618 to 1648. This was a biggie. And without getting too carried away with the details, because this is, the 30 Years' War was a big mess, and it's super confusing. But what basically happened was, it became clear, as your book says, that the Catholic forces could not subdue the Protestants in northern Germany. The Protestants could not control the Catholics in the south. Not only that, but the whole religious tone of the war at the beginning ended up becoming more of a political power struggle for land. Like I said, people would start using it in the name of religion, but it was really all about getting more land, and people were just being greedy and stuff. And so it was just a big mess, a big war. And so in the end, everybody realized the whole situation was futile. I mean, here's a map of Germany. I know, look at this. The whole Roman Empire, Germany, whatever. This is 1648. I mean, it's crazy. It's like, oh, we own this. Oh, wait, we're over here. We own this. I mean, it's just a mess. And so it's like, okay. In the end, everybody just realized the whole situation was futile and futile.
What are the colors?
Oh, yeah, you can't read the... Oh, gosh, I can't even read it on here.
What's that little purple? What's the purple?
Western
Eritrea, not Eritrea, that's in Africa.
The second one?
I made that up. Western Alliance, I can't really...
The point is...
If I could close it and open... if I could zoom in...
Yeah, purple is the craziest territories.
Yeah, what are they doing? I know, they're here, they're up there, it's like, my goodness, guys, come on.
A little speckle over there to the left.
I know. It looks very colorful, though, so they probably liked that part of the map. It's like, well, at least this looks pretty. Anyway. And so, basically, they realized how ridiculous the whole situation was. They're like, we give up. We throw in the towel. And so they stopped being so antagonistic toward each other out of sheer pointlessness. Honestly, I think everybody just got weary of the whole thing. And so, in 1648, which is a really important date, the Peace of Westphalia was signed, which ended the 30 Years' War. It also ended the 80 Years' War between Spain and the Netherlands, which was going on at the same time. But most significantly, the Peace of Westphalia made Calvinism, Lutheranism, and Catholicism recognize faiths that could coexist within a particular nation or territory if the government desired it. If the ruling government said, we want everybody to just be in the same place and, you know, we're not going to have an official Catholic territory, an official Calvinist territory, we're just going to all be together. That was huge. This is a huge step towards modernization, right? I mean, that and the Council of Trent were major steps in bringing us to where we are today. And so this is why we say that the Reformation ended here, because from this point on, the concept of coexistence of the within the Christian faith spread, all right, from that point to where we are now. And so eventually, all Protestant groups would have be officially accepted as time went on. You know, that took time, but still, this was a huge, huge step, like I said. And interestingly, the Pope was excluded from involvement in these decisions. He was no part of the Peace of Westphalia. And so for the first time since Constantine's day, really, I mean, that's how far back this goes, guys. For the first time since Constantine's day, the church, the Catholic Church, the Pope, was not a major player in making these decisions. And so that meant that now on some level, we almost have a separation of church and state. What it really meant was that the Pope no longer ruled Europe. I mean, that was already happening. It was already in the works. And, you know, like I said, even way back at the Great Schism, people could see that it was the beginning of the end and the downfall and the decline of the church. But now, I mean, it's definitely come to pass where people are making their own decisions politically apart from the influence of the Almighty Church. And so, Soane says, Protestantism had attained a twofold object in spite of the Jesuits. It had not only maintained itself, but it had changed the aspect of the whole political world by the destruction of the supremacy of the papacy, the earthly supremacy of the Pope, basically. And as a side note to all of this religious and political modernization happening in Europe, the Puritans over in America also helped bring the church to the place that it is today. I guess you'd say, religiously speaking. Basically, you know, so we got, you know, the Council of Trent, we have the Peace of Westphalia, and then over in America, basically the American colonists had the benefit of learning from Europe's mistakes. You know, all of the war, all of the craziness, all of the upheaval and the hatred and the, you know, death and fighting, they saw all the drama, they saw all this ugliness, and they decided that they wanted to run things differently in their neck of the woods. You know, when they come over to America, it's like, we've got a clean slate here. Let's not get into this nonsense that's going on back home. And so this is where we see the development of what we call denominationalism. Again, another major modernizing step here that happened. It actually became more popularly accepted and more widely practiced later on in the 1700s, but it first emerged in the 1600s, during this time in the American colonies and in the teachings of the English Congregationalists. And they articulated this theory during the Westminster Assembly. I put that up on the board. We talked about that last week. That was that time. The Westminster Assembly, that was during that whole time when England didn't have a monarchy. Remember when there was a Commonwealth, right, under Oliver Cromwell, and England, like, had overthrown the king temporarily? That's when the Puritans ruled. Hopefully you guys remember that.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, somebody just say yes, thank you. They were just kind of like, we're done. Whoa, I know, we surrender, white flag. Okay. So, all right, during that time, the Westminster Assembly, this was when the idea of denominations first had kind of popped out, you know, and then later in America they ran with it. And so what happened in the colonies, well, was that, you know, you've got all of these, basically a lot of the early settlers in America were religious refugees, right? They're all running away from this nonsense in Europe. They're getting out of the wars, and we don't want to be involved in this. This is crazy, you know, everybody's getting persecuted and killed. So these refugees from all branches of the Christian faith start coming over to the American colonies. You've got the Calvinists, you've got Lutherans, you've got Puritans, you've got English Baptists, Quakers, Catholics, even them, they were persecuted too. They came and settled in Maryland. And they're all fleeing to the new colonies and settling in various areas, and they've been doing this since 1607, right, when that first colony in Jamestown was established. And so, you know, the Puritans up in New England, they were a little bit more dogmatic about their particular set of beliefs, but there were checks and balances that kept them from getting carried away, from being too, you know, hard on the other groups. And your book talks about that. Because we got a very unique environment here in America. Everything was so new, and for the most part, everybody in those early days was just trying to survive, you know, especially in New England. You know, when you hit your first winter there, it was like, you know, it just like devastated people. So many of them died. They're just trying to survive. And so all of this other stuff, like what are our differences theologically, all of that stuff got pushed to the wayside. It's like, it doesn't really matter. We're just trying to survive. You're trying to survive. Let's try to survive together. Let's try to make this work. And so there was a general attitude of camaraderie and acceptance towards one another, you know, because they just had to for the sake of survival and for the sake of trying to start a new, fresh thing, you know. And again, a lot of these groups didn't want to have all that fighting anymore. They were over it. And so it's like, can we just, you know, try to agree on what we can agree on and agree to disagree on those other non-essentials. And so basically, and your book talks about this, it didn't mean that all faiths and all religions were equal in the eyes of the American colonists, and that's important distinction to make, because nowadays people act like, oh, that, you know, back then they were fine with all faiths and embracing. I've heard that before from, and it's like, no, that wasn't true. They were embracing one another within the Christian faith, you know, as true. And so, in the eyes of the American colonists, as long as your core biblical beliefs were held, they were all part of the same Christian family, basically. The true church just consisted of those who believed in the Word of God. And from there, it's like, okay, maybe you baptize differently than we do, maybe you do this or that, but those are non-essentials. We're going to focus on the essentials and find fellowship in that. So, really cool, you know, that's a healthy thing. And, you know, the only people who really got shafted in this were the Quakers. Because Quakers were kind of weird. They had this thing called the Inner Light, which was supposed to be like the Holy Spirit, I guess. And they also have women preachers, which a lot of people were like, oh, I don't know about that. So, but, I mean, they were crazy. There were a couple of, like, Quaker preacher women that were kind of wild. There was this lady named Elizabeth Hooten, and she got persecuted by the Puritans up in New England or something like that. They ended up like dragging her behind a horse and cart for 80 miles into the wilderness. And she, once they let her go, she just got up and walked back into town again and started preaching. I mean, this lady was hardcore. And there was this other lady, I think her name was Mary Fisher. Yeah, Mary Fisher. And she felt like God called the Inner Light. God told her to go and preach the gospel to the Sultan of Turkey. So somehow, by herself, she got on a ship, went to Turkey, shared the gospel with the Sultan, and he's like, will you please stay and can share this with, you know, my subjects, my people? And she's like, no, I've done what God told me to do. I've got to go now. And she turned around and just left. It's like, okay, you have this huge opportunity, lady. Anyway. So they were interesting. The Quakers were quite a unique group, you know, and they make good oatmeal. But anyway. So the Quakers kind of, like I said, they got the shaft, but most groups generally were accepted among one another. And in theory, this is what Calvin and Luther always believed and taught, but in their day and age, it was just too hard to make something like that happen because of that whole mentality in Europe that one religion can exist in one place, you know, it's like, or one religion existing in one region or something like that. And so it was a lot easier, basically, for something like this to happen, denominationalism to take place in a new nation like America. And so the concept of denominations developed to what we have today, and that's become kind of, I guess you'd say, the accepted system of Christianity that we have now, following those fundamentals that were laid down by the Congregationalists. And your book goes into that. So with that, in kind of wrapping it up here, we can see, I'm so proud of myself. We can see why all of these things were so key. You know, why the Peace of Westphalia was so critical and why it signifies the end of the Reformation as, you know, religious coexistence was now in play, which that was a huge deal. And then you can see why the Council of Trent was significant in separating the Protestant and the Catholic faith to where it is today. And then you can see how denominationalism is significant. as major steps here were being taken to come out of the Middle Ages in every way. We're really coming into a more modern method of political government and church government. And of course, modern is a relative term. To us, we can see this and say, oh good, they were finally becoming modern. But to these guys, this was all just revolutionary. I mean, you gotta imagine, there's a lot of mind-boggling change going on. You know, and if you live 70 or 80 or 80 years, I mean, you experienced, you know, so much change over the course of that time. You know, if you lived during Luther's time and watched all the wars and everything, I mean, you just saw so much happening, so much upheaval. But we see it now and we see like, oh, that brought us to where we are today. And so from this time on, the church was not only diverse within itself, but it was permanently divided from being so connected to the government, you know, and trying to rule society together and that sort of a thing. So the Reformation ran its course, it accomplished its purposes. Historians actually attribute capitalism, education, science, and missions to the Reformation. And so now we're going to see next week that it wasn't just time for new religious and political developments, but theological, philosophical developments were going to take place. And so basically, now that there's not so much war going on, people are going to be sitting around and thinking a lot more. And so we'll come up with some new ideas and concepts. And so that'll bring us into the Age of Reason and revivals, like the Great Awakening and stuff, which happened in the mid-1600s into the 1700s. And we're going to lump all of this together with the whole Church of Sardis time period, just so you know. We're going to call it all like the Reformation era. I'm just kind of lump it in. Because it leads us, it's really, the Age of Reason and revival is really a bridge into the missionary movement, which is our next major time period. So, okay? Are we good? Can you survive this? Let's pray. Lord, thank you so much, God, that, again, and I just feel like, I just always say this every week, Lord, but I'm reminded again just how you've had your hand on your church, Lord. Through all the upheaval, all the turmoil, all the mistakes that people made, and just, you know, getting off base and off track and everything. And yet, you've kept it together, God. And I think this just testifies, once again, to your power and your ability and the fact that this is a work of your Spirit. It's not by might or by power. It's by your Spirit, Lord. And, you know, the gates of hell cannot prevail against your church. It just goes to show because it's something that you've set up, God, and that you are moving and working in, Lord. And we thank you for that reminder, God, because that just reminds us again in our day and age when things look bleak or at times when there's just a lot of chaos in society and stuff, Lord, you are still moving, you are still working, and you want to use us, Lord. And so please, God, even in small ways, Lord, this week would you use us, Lord? We want to be available, we want to be open and willing in whatever capacity, like Brother Lawrence talked about, doing even the little things that we do for you, Lord, unto you, and for your glory, God. You know, that can all be done as an expression of our love for you and can be used to point other people to you. So may we just be ready for those divine appointments and opportunities you might provide for us this week. So we love you, Jesus, and commit our time to you here and our week as we go forward. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen, guys. You made it all the way through, David. Well done.
Yeah, right now, like, I was closing my eyes and I
don't
want to open up.
Yeah. You're like half asleep. It's all right. I'm really tired, too. I didn't get a lot of sleep last night, so I'm kind of leaving today. That's somehow we made it. You guys seem to be tracking.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right,
Joey. Yeah, seriously.
Something I thought I was thinking about last week, I almost emailed you about,
yes,
was Luther, how he prayed to Saint Homegirl. What was the girl?
Saint Homegirl.
Saint
Anne.
Saint Anne. During the storm.
Oh, yeah.
And then
I like Saint Homegirl.
I don't. Yeah, I can't remember her name. And then, you know, having studied scripture and everything, probably ended up coming to a point where he, like, turned away from believing that St. Anne had any effect in saving him.
Like
what?
How did...
Because, like, you know, in the 95 thesis, I'm brought up something about idols and,
yeah,
you know, saints not really having any authority over,
like... Right.